and radio presenter Dr. Michael Mosley on the Greek island of Symi. The 67-year-old went missing on Wednesday after setting off on a walk. Authorities have been searching for Dr. Mosley in a remote mountainous area. The body was discovered next to a fence, a short distance from the busy Agia Marina beach. Formal identification is yet to take place, but a police source told BBC News the person had been dead for a number of days. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says 274 Palestinians were killed during an Israeli rescue operation yesterday. Israeli security forces freed four hostages from the central Nuseirat refugee camp. Israel has previously estimated there were fewer than 100 casualties and accused Hamas of hiding behind civilians. The Reform Party leader Nigel Farage is facing criticism from both Labour and the Conservatives for claiming that Rishi Sunak doesn't understand what he called our history and culture. Mr. Farage defended his comments made about the Prime Minister's decision to leave D-Day commemorations in Normandy early, saying they were about class rather than Mr. Sunak's South Asian background. Cabinet Minister Mel Stride said the comments were deeply regrettable. Labour's Shadow Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood called them completely unacceptable. An investigation's begun into how a funfair ride malfunctioned, injuring four people, including an 11-year-old girl. The accident happened during the Lambeth Country Show in Brockwell Park yesterday evening. The London Ambulance Service said all four people were taken to major trauma centres. Narendra Modi will be sworn in as India's Prime Minister for a third time this afternoon. He won the most votes at a recent election, but his party, the BJP, didn't do as well as he'd wanted, meaning he'll have to share power with smaller parties. Millions of voters in 21 countries across the European Union are taking part in the final day of elections to the European Parliament. A rise in support for right and far-right representatives has been forecast. And the weather, a largely cloudy afternoon with spells of persistent rain moving across the west. Tonight, the rain will become heavy across parts of Wales and the Midlands at times, and it'll be cooler in the north. And that's the BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12. Now, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
For years, Professor Brian Cox has encouraged us to look up to and beyond the stars and to understand that the universe is very, very large and our place in it is very, very small. He's Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Manchester, and through his extensive work on television and radio, he's shared the wonders of the universe and of science with millions of us around the world. Brian, as a teenager and then student, you combined your passion for physics with a parallel career in pop music as a keyboard player, and your choices today include music from that brilliant jazz improviser Keith Jarrett, as well as Mahler, Charles Ives. But I think we begin with Richard Strauss.
Yes, thus spoke Zarathustra. I think everybody knows, of course, the first couple of minutes made famous by 2001. That's not a coincidence, I think, because the whole piece is inspired by Nietzsche's book, which is an exploration of many ways to put it. But the way I put it is, what does it mean to live a finite, fragile life in an infinite, eternal universe? Or how can we, as humans, justify our existence when faced with the unlimited power of nature? And these are questions that, of course, occur to anyone who contemplates the size and scale of the universe for just a moment. Just the idea that there are 400 billion stars in our galaxy alone, 2 trillion of those galaxies in the observable universe, which is a small patch of a potentially infinite universe beyond, I think strikes terror into the heart or the mind of anyone who contemplates it. And of course, it's obviously not just scientists that contemplate the meaning of what we've discovered about the power of nature. The great artists across many centuries have thought about this. And of course, Nietzsche and Strauss did. And so I've always thought that you won't find meaning through the eyepiece of a telescope. So what science can do is challenge you intellectually. But what we're to make of it, how we're to respond, requires other lights to be shone on the problem. And I think Zarathustra is one of the most illuminating lights on this problem of existence. And it was crafted to be that way. It's remarkable music. And I was introduced to it quite late, actually, by a friend of mine who's a conductor, Ben Northey. And I hadn't listened beyond that first few minutes. And the rest of it is, I can't say better, can I? But it's so familiar. He said to me that that piece is a victim of its own success in 2001. So this piece is the second part of The Backworldsman. It's where Zarathustra has come out of his cave and he meets a saint in the woods. And this section references the Catholic Mass. It mines the history of religious music quite beautifully, actually. But just as a piece, it's supposed to represent the seductiveness of religion as an answer to these deep questions.
It's beautiful, but there's something about the heaving enormity of being in the universe about that music, the struggle of people. There's tension, in fact.
Yeah, it's all the way through the piece, there's a debate, really. Nature is always there, and humanity is always there. The end is so magnificent because it's left unresolved. So nature's key is C, C major, and humanity, humans, are often B minor and B major in different parts. And at the end, it's just remarkable. There's this beautiful chord. It's a B major chord is played by the woodwind. And then there's a C bass, it goes bang. And so there's this beautiful humans, we've sorted it, we understand our place. And then the nature goes bang at the end. And it just fades away. As you said, it's not only beautiful music, but intellectually, the whole thing. I remember Ben Northey saying to me, the orchestra love playing this. It's some of the most beautiful music we have ever or will ever play.
We heard Of the Backworldsman, part two of Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Brian Cox, you grew up in Oldham, didn't you? Tell us a little bit about your early life, what it was like growing up there.
Yes, I was born in 1968 in Oldham. It's a mill town. The whole industry, the reason the place is there is because it rains because of the presence of the Pennines. I still love it. The scenery around the town is absolutely beautiful. I spent quite a lot of time with my grandparents because my parents both worked. When I was at school, I used to go back to my grandparents' house for lunch and things. And they were interesting people because my grandfather was born in 1900. So he was a Victorian, actually quite literally a Victorian. And so it was an interesting connection to the past that I grew up with someone who'd lived through the First World War and the Second World War.
Your granddad had done an HND in chemistry. So did he encourage you down a scientific route?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, he used to build things. So he built me a shed, which is just basically a wooden box in his garden that we wired up with batteries and lights and switches and things like that. I mean, he started working in the mills in Oldham when he was 14 and then subsequently moved into the dyeing industry, the chemicals industry, and had got this HND, which I've got on my wall at home. He was very, very proud of it. So he'd almost educated himself, actually. So he introduced me to science, but also music. He had one of those, which I wish I still had, a radiogram, you know, a valve radiogram. And those valve amplifiers, there's a sound to them. I remember the music, but I also remember the sound of that thing, you know, this beautiful wooden inlays on the radio with the light service, you know, the old BBC channels sort of written on it in wood.
It's Rodgers and Hammerstein that you've chosen next.
Yeah, that was the music that he liked. So Oklahoma, South Pacific, Sound of Music. We listened to those musicals a lot. And I think it really did strongly influence my musical taste because that kind of harmony, that kind of use of chords was, I suppose it's the first time that I really was introduced to or listened to music. So I didn't listen to the pop music of the time, like the Beatles or anything until later on. So I was listening to Richard Rodgers.
Which number have you chosen for us?
So I chose from Oklahoma, People Will Say We're In Love. I think it's a beautiful song. It's a simple song. There's something about the sound of it. When I went back to listen, actually, when I was thinking about this programme, that just sounds like my early childhood, that song.
Do they think up stories that link my name with yours?
Why do the neighbors gossip all day behind their doors?
I know a way to prove what they say is quite untrue. Here is the gist, a practical list of don'ts for you. Don't throw bouquets at me. Don't please my folks too much. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love. Don't sigh me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't start collecting.
Some people claim that you are to blame as much as I. Why do you take the trouble to bake my favorite pie? Grant your wish, I carved our initials on that tree. Just keep a slice of all the advice you give so free. Don't praise my charm too much. Don't look so vain with me. Don't stand in the rain with me. People will say we're in love. Don't take my arm too much. Don't keep your hand in mine. Your hand feels so grand in mine. Stars fade from above. They'll see it's all right with me.
I know exactly what you mean about that conjuring up a period, and it's extraordinary how music can do that, almost date your chronology.
Yeah, there's something about that bass line, the way that it just swings. And I did, by the way, just listening to it then, I did Richard Rodgers a disservice, actually. I said it was one of his simpler songs, but actually, you know, it's effortless. It's not simple. It's extremely clever. And it never left me. You know, I love musicals to this day, and it's, I suppose, a great introduction to harmony. You know, if you want to learn how to structure a song, you listen to that.
People Will Say We're In Love, sung by Gordon McRae and Shirley Jones, and performed by Jay Blackton and his orchestra, composed by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, from the 1955 soundtrack of Oklahoma. Brian, when you went to grammar school, did you have any science then that began to excite you?
Yeah, I'd been interested in astronomy for some reason, for as long as I can remember. Something captured my imagination about the stars. And I'd made the connection between astronomy, the romance of the night sky, and physics. And that's quite a sophisticated connection. I don't know why I made that connection when I was 11 years old, but when I went to grammar school, I wanted to do physics. I was highly motivated to do that subject. So I worked really hard at physics and found it exciting.
And did you learn a musical instrument?
No, not really, the recorder, as everyone else did. But I taught myself music. It was really because I wanted to be in a band. It was when I was about 15, so I hadn't had music lessons of any sort beyond the recorder. And then as I started to get into popular music, it was initially electronic music that I liked in the late 70s, early 80s. And a friend of mine up the road had been taught how to play. He was actually a church organist. And so we formed a band together. And I started to just learn how to play keyboards. And even that's rather too grandiose a description of what I was doing. I had one finger and I was playing little noises, basically. And then we made a demo tape, and my dad met in the pub the keyboard player from the band Thin Lizzy, Darren Wharton. And he must have just filed it away and thought, well, there's some guy up the road who plays keyboards. And then when he came to form his own band, it was when I was 18 years old, he got in touch and said, do you want to come down and see if you can audition for the band? And I wasn't a very good musician, but I was good at programming keyboards. So I could do the tech. And that's basically what he wanted.
Yeah, so you were playing by ear quite a lot rather than from music.
Yeah, and I still do, so I don't really read music. If you shout, you know, D diminished at me or C minor 7, I'll play it. So it's a very kind of rock and roll type musician. So I don't read the dots. I still don't read the dots. Actually, I've never taught myself to do that.
So this band was Dare that you were in now?
It's a band called Dare, yes. Yeah. And basically, I was on my way to university when I was 18. I took a year off and the band got a record deal. And we ended up making albums for 5 years. So that's where I really learned how to play, just through sheer practice of playing live shows.
What kind of look did the band have, if you can bear to remember?
Oh, yeah, long hair. You know, this is mid to late 80s. It's what Bon Jovi would have looked like if they come from Oldham. if you can imagine that.
Well, it's music from the film Interstellar next. The film follows a group of astronauts who travel through a wormhole in search of a new home for humankind.
Yeah, so I grew up with this love of astronomy. The 70s, of course, it was Star Wars, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Alien, science fiction, Star Trek as well, came into my world. And the whole thing was mixed up in my mind, and still is, actually. Interstellar, I think, is a magnificent film. I'd become quite friendly, to my astonishment, with Kip Thorne, one of my heroes. He's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist for the discovery of gravitational waves, which are ripples in the fabric of the universe caused by the collisions of black holes and neutron stars and the violent events in the universe. So he's one of the greats, Kip Thorne. And he essentially came up with the idea of that film as a way of demonstrating the strangeness of relativity. So the strange ideas that, for example, time would pass very much more slowly for someone close to a black hole than someone far away from the black hole. And he took that and turned it, with Chris Nolan, into a, I don't know, an emotional journey through the ideas of relativity. I love the film Interstellar. I think it's a superb piece of work. And the music is a big part of it. And Hans Zimmer, I think, is a composer. And I've got to know Hans as well, again, to my great surprise. One of the things about being in my position is you're fortunate enough to meet some of your heroes and some wonderful people. And Hans is another one. And I think that he's one of the great film composers. The music is such a part of the emotional journey of that incredibly clever film.
Thank you.
you know, you hear there why Hans Zimmer, such a, as well as being a great musician, he's such an intelligent person, a deep thinker. Because that piece in the film is with the black hole, this thing gargantua. And black holes, in Einstein's description, in pure relativity, they're places where space and time are so distorted that time appears to stop on the event horizon of a black hole when viewed from outside. And space and time flip roles when you go across the horizon into the interior. It's a live area of research, what's happening in there. But the Einsteinian description is time stops. So inside that strange, distorted region of space lies the end of time. And what you hear in that music, you can hear it, but you can also hear that ticking of time. And of course, we all eventually hear that clock ticking.
I love the way Hans Zimmer brings in that organ from Temple Church in London, which sort of adds a grandeur.
Yeah, when you are talking about these tremendously powerful and deep existential questions, one of the ways that we've explored those questions historically has been religion. I would go as far as to say it's a necessary but not sufficient mode of exploration. That's why, by the way, I like to mix in the things that I do. I like to mix the science with music and philosophy and indeed theology and literature and art, because I think that all these things, all these different disciplines are different lights that you shine on the central problem. This Platonic idea that we only have access to the shadows, but the more shadows that you can cast, the more likely you are to gain deeper insight into these problems and challenges. And so it's not a coincidence that composers like Hans Zimmer and Strauss use these religious allegories or associations or echo religious ideas in the music, because it's a shortcut to contemplating the infinite. Right? When you hear a church organ, you're tuned. It's almost like a Pavlovian response, isn't it, to think about grandeur and mystery.
Well, we heard an excerpt from Murph from Hans Zimmer's Interstellar, the original soundtrack recording for the 2014 film, which, as I said, featured the organist and musical director of the Temple Church in London, Roger Sayer, playing the church's 1926 four-manual Harrison and Harrison organ. Going back to your keyboard playing, Brian Cox, with Dare, what were your experiences being with a band like that?
Rock
Are they
and roll
repeatable?
In the late 80s. I'll take the Fifth Amendment. Well, I mean, we had a good time. And the first, we were with A&M Records, and they'd said to us, we're going to record the album with two producers, actually, a producer called Mike Shipley, who was very famous for having worked with bands like Def Leppard and Queen, I think, in the earlier years. And Larry Klein, who's a great musician, who was at the time married to Joni Mitchell. And so we ended up in Joni Mitchell's studio in her house in Los Angeles, and also Dave Gilmour's old studio in Henley called Hookend Manor. So suddenly you're immersed in this world of Pink Floyd and Joni Mitchell. And then the first live show we did was supporting Jimmy Page, of all people.
Wow.
So suddenly we're immersed in the history of rock music. And so it was quite an introduction to mingle with these people.
Well, clearly you were heading for the stars. So why did it come to an end?
The band didn't end, the band Dare, but we kind of had a bit of an altercation. The band as a whole had a
surely
kind of
not,
a crisis.
Surely not, Brian. Falling rock out in a band.
Yeah, we had a fight in a bar in Berlin. I think the pressure got too much for us, really. We had a huge record deal. We were on the edge of the charts and it just wasn't quite going right. And so the band kind of fragmented for a while, and I left and a few of the other members left, and then they got back together again and are still playing. But I'd always wanted to be a physicist, an astronomer, actually. And so I left the tour halfway through in Germany, came back to Oldham. I think it was October. I rang Manchester University and said, right, I want to come now. And they let me in. But I had to wait a year. And so I got a job as a sound engineer, going around touring, mixing sound for bands and things like that. And got accidentally introduced to another band, D-Ream, who were more famous than Dare. And I ended up playing a bit of keyboards for D-Ream. And then D-Ream got a record deal. And ultimately, songs like Things Can Only Get Better ended up at number one in the charts. So I ended up, in parallel with doing physics at university, having a second career in music, very different kind of music, which finally led to me going on Top of the Pops, which I'd always wanted to do when I was growing up.
Is there still footage of you playing on Top of the Pops?
Oh, yeah, very famously, wearing a tartan suit. So you can find it.
Well,
I don't recommend anyone does.
You've certainly gone for some quite monumental pieces of music. And the next one, of course, is Mahler.
Yes, after my physics degree, I really enjoyed it and managed to get a place doing a PhD in particle physics. And I was based in Hamburg, the particle collider there called HERA, which collided electrons and protons together. So I was in Hamburg. So Mahler's Second was performed. It was the 100th anniversary of the first performance.
The Resurrection.
And a friend of mine had said, we have to go to this, and they got tickets. And I went, and it was one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. And the end of Mahler's Second Symphony is one of the most celebratory, life-affirming, astonishing pieces of music ever written. And it's also one of the loudest things I'd ever heard. Because when you hear this live, you know, with the choir and the organ and a massive orchestra, just the sheer power and the beauty of the music, just I was completely overwhelmed by it. And that was my introduction to Mahler.
Thank you.
You don't have much choice there, do you?
What can you say? I mean, I just say anyone, if you ever get a chance to go and see that live, it's just everything. The church bells are going, everything's going at the end. It's incredible.
The end of Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, performed by the soprano Barbara Hendricks, the mezzo-soprano Christa Ludwig, the Westminster Choir, and the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. And I can just see Lenny leaping up in the air as he got towards that climax.
He drags out that ending, doesn't he? But why wouldn't you?
Brian Cox, we had a physicist, Harry Cliff, on recently, and he equally loved music by Mahler and Richard Strauss. So I can't help wondering if this is just a coincidence, or do you think there's something about these epic orchestral works that have a particular appeal to physicists because they conjure up the world you're dealing with?
Yeah, I think they're a deliberate exploration of the ideas that are raised, the intellectual challenges raised by science, by physics and cosmology. And the interesting thing is, of course, that these composers at the time, we're talking about the end of the 19th century, they didn't know the half of it. I mean, the universe is significantly larger and stranger than anyone possibly could have imagined at the time that music was written.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the physicist, Professor Brian Cox. In 2008, you were the spokesperson, weren't you, for the switching on of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. That must have been an incredibly exciting day.
Yeah, I mean, I got the chance. Radio 4 allowed me to be part of that broadcast. That's what I was doing. And I was working at CERN anyway. But I was very lucky because very, very few people at CERN at the time got to be in the control room of the Large Hadron Collider at those critical moments when we were sending the beams around the machine for the first time. And so I was extremely lucky that I got to be involved in that. You know, that machine, it's still the frontier of particle research. And although famously we discovered the Higgs particle, which was a very big news, there's a huge amount of new knowledge being generated by that machine all the time. And we don't know what we're going to find in the next few years. So it's actually now, although it's not in the news headlines as much at the moment, it's as exciting there as it ever was.
What we've been talking about, of course, is in many ways the unanswered question. And it's that wonderful piece by Charles Ives that you've chosen next.
It is. It's explicitly, what is it called? The perennial question of existence. I think Ives said that that's what it's about. So this music explicitly gets more and more confused and frustrated. The beautiful strings represent the Druids, don't they? This kind of calm there. And then there's an increasingly violent, almost atonal argument. And I like that. I like the fact that there's no sense in which this question is answered, which is, I suppose, why it's called the unanswered question.
And to give a sort of visual analogy, which might help people who are listening, is, of course, when it's done at the proms, the solo trumpet is often up in the gallery, away from the strings. So you have that kind of separation.
Yeah, it's like a lone voice, isn't it, of asking questions. And that staging, it's why, if you can, attending concerts brings a whole other dimension to the music. These are pieces of theatre as well as just music.
Thank you.
It's strangely haunting, isn't it?
Yes, as you said, it's that trumpet just keeps asking this question. And the woodwind gets so frustrated in the end. I like that. It stop it.
The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives, performed by the Orchestra of St. Luke's, conducted by John Adams. Now, Brian, since you are clearly so good at your homework, I think I have to set you a little task now, which is that there's a piece by the Hungarian composer called George Kurtag, wonderful composer, called The Answered Unanswered Question.
Is there? What's the answer? I'd love to know.
I think you have to listen to it at some point.
Well, thank you. I will do that.
In 2009, you were offered the chance to make your first big documentary series, The Wonders of the Solar System. Do you recall filming that, and how did you choose what to include? After all, there was so much. You visited Saturn's rings, I think.
Yeah, it was a wonderful opportunity. I couldn't really believe it. The idea was that we would find locations on Earth that spoke to these locations in the solar system that, of course, we couldn't visit. So the volcanoes of Jupiter's moon Io, for example, there's obvious you go to a lava lake or a volcano. Saturn's rings, we chose a glacial lagoon in Iceland because Saturn's rings are made of water ice primarily. One of the most remarkable experiences was filming a solar eclipse, total solar eclipse, and it was in Varanasi in India. And if ever you want to see the sun vanish from the sky, then Varanasi is the place to see it. Just so fortunate. And it was miraculous almost because it was cloudy. And then just before the eclipse, the skies cleared. And there must have been a million people plus on the banks of the Ganges. I really felt, I said it, and it's in the programme, that when the moon obscures the sun and everything goes dark and you see that this thing is a spherical object that's moved in front of another spherical object and you're on a spherical object, and suddenly I felt that I was on a rock in space. And it's the first time I've ever felt it. Of course, we are all sat on a rock in space, but we don't think about it. It's obscured from us. And that's one of the things about nature, the power and violence of nature that we've been talking about all the way through. It's mainly obscured from our perception, but just occasionally something happens. Actually, as we record now, a few nights ago, the aurora, the northern lights, came to all of England. And again, that's another moment where you suddenly see the violence and power of nature. It makes you think.
Your horizon shows, which you've toured around the world for the last few years, combine music with questions about the universe. And a piece that you use, we're going to hear next, and in fact, it's another piece from Alter Sprach Zarathustra.
Oh, yes. So this is the dance song towards the end, when Zarathustra essentially dances up to the cosmos, leaving humanity behind, actually. So Zarathustra is ascending, transcending his earthly existence. And in the live show, I interpret it as not Zarathustra's transcendence, but our transcendence. What would a human future amongst the stars look like if we can transcend and survive the problems that we face now on Earth? And I think it's vitally important, by the way, because many of my colleagues, and I share this view, would guess that the number of civilizations on the average per galaxy in the universe may be of order zero. Right, so many galaxies may not even host a civilization. Ours does, and we may be the only one. And so that idea that we may one day transcend this planet and move ours to the stars becomes an extremely important one, because to put it bluntly, if we don't do it, then nobody else may do it. And we've spoken about all the way through this idea of meaning, and it doesn't sound like a particularly scientific word, meaning. So what is it? I would argue that whatever it is, it clearly exists here because the universe means something to each of us. Of course, our lives mean something to us. We are human. But if it's a property of complex biological systems, and I would argue that it is, so you need things like human brains at that level of complexity to bring meaning into the world, and then the world means something to it, to this brain, then this planet might be the only place where meaning exists currently, in the Milky Way galaxy, in an island of 400 billion suns. And therefore, if we don't move outwards to the stars and carry meaning with us, then the galaxy may return to be being meaningless again, as it probably was for 13 billion years. So this piece of music, in my interpretation, it's celebratory. It's Zarathustra dancing up to the cosmos, but it's us dancing up to the cosmos. And if we do not dance up to the cosmos, nobody in the cosmos is dancing.
Thank you.
to me, the imagery that conjures up is starships heading out to Alpha Centauri and beyond to explore the galaxy, humanity spreading out amongst the stars. And you can hear it in that. It's just celebratory and magnificent.
We heard the dance song from Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. I can't help wondering, Brian Cox, whether you're not a frustrated astronaut. Would you like to be an astronaut?
Yes, I would love to see the Earth from space. I've been very lucky to talk personally, to speak to astronauts from the Apollo program onwards. I'm so lucky because they were my heroes when I was growing up. And all of them say seeing the Earth from space changes their life, changes their view of humanity, its value and our place in the universe. So obviously I want to experience it.
The climate emergency is obviously one of the biggest challenges facing us as a species. Do you think we'll make it?
It's a very good question. There's an idea called the Fermi paradox, which was after the great physicist Enrico Fermi. He asked the question, where are the other civilizations? It's a paradox because we live in a galaxy of 400 billion stars and trillions of planets. It's been here for 13 billion years. There's been plenty of time for some civilization far in advance of us to essentially write the evidence of their existence across the sky. And nobody's done it. So why? One answer might be the biology. It might just be so rare for life to become this complex. But the other possibility is that civilizations don't make it through this point in our history. Because there will be a point in every industrial civilization's history when it's on the verge of becoming essentially immortal, developing the technology to head outwards to the stars. Then there is a point when you challenge your climate of your planet and you gain control of the atom, let's say the nucleus, you develop nuclear power, nuclear weapons. So you develop the capability to destroy yourselves through deliberate action or inaction. And the question is, well, maybe that's the reason for what's called the Great Silence. That's what astronomers call it, because civilizations don't make it much beyond this point. It's basically stupidity. Or to put it more charitably, is the fact that our knowledge, our scientific knowledge and engineering prowess, technological prowess, exceeds our political ability. For the first time in our history, it is necessary for us to run a planet together, not a country or even a continent, but to run a planet. So yes, there are many challenges that we face now, but ultimately they come down to the challenge of finding a way to live together without destroying ourselves, accidentally or deliberately, on a single piece of rock. And if we don't do that, then, as I said before, we might be responsible for destroying meaning in a galaxy of 400 billion suns, potentially forever.
We've been talking a lot about going into space, going up to the stars, and we are now at least going to go over the rainbow, aren't we?
So Keith Jarrett, so I learned to play piano just through listening, played along to songs and Elton John, Billy Joel. I tried to do it with Oscar Peterson and it got more difficult. I can't do that.
How about and Thelonious then, Monk?
Yeah, Thelonious Monk, you know, George Shearing, and you go, I can't do this now. I can't tell what they're doing. But Somewhere Over the Rainbow, everybody knows the song. It's an evocative song. Everyone encounters it in The Wizard of Oz, of course, when they're growing up. But what Jarrett is able to do, and this is a live performance, I have endless debates with friends of mine about which is the best version that he's played of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It comes to blows, right? Because people have their own favourite version. This one for me is La Scala. It's from that album. And it's one of the later performances, actually. And I just think it's absolute genius. It's so melodic. It's simple at first sight. He's absolutely true to the brilliance of the song. But actually, harmonically, the things that he's doing, the chord substitutions he's making, the melodies that he's finding, the kind of counterpoint melodies that he discovers, he invents in this performance, are beyond anything that I can imagine ever being able to achieve. I don't know how he did it. It's just the finest piece of piano playing I've ever heard. See, isn't that perfect?
It's extraordinary where he takes it. And there was one harmonic thing which had my hair standing on end.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, I think. I just think it's quite magical.
Over the Rainbow, originally composed by Harold Arlen, but recreated there by Keith Jarrett. Brian Cox, do you think that we do enough in this country to champion the current work of scientists and to invest in science? Particle physics is very expensive. So how do you respond to those who see investment in particle physics as some sort of luxury?
It's not expensive. We don't, as a civilization, we spend very little on science, and our entire civilization is built on it. It's literally peanuts. So we spend more on peanuts than we do. One part of science is asteroid defense, which is trying to understand how asteroids orbit around the Earth and whether any of them will be a threat and so on. And we spent less on that than we did on ringtones for mobile phones. So it depends what you mean by expensive. You take CERN as an example. The knowledge that we take for granted now, today, medical imaging, for example, that technology came from particle physics. PET scan, what's that? Positron emission tomography. What's a positron? It's an antimatter electron. Well, how do we understand those things? Because people were playing around in the 1930s. So it seems so obvious to me. Virtually everything we take for granted today is built on a curiosity-led discovery that was made at some point in the past. And at every point in the past, by the way, you can hear people making the argument that we know enough. Surely we know enough. People were making that argument at the end of the 19th century. There's a few I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, but we know enough. And then we discovered quantum mechanics because people were playing around and trying to understand the light from atoms because they thought it was interesting. That's the foundation of electronics. So the people who tweet the fact that we spend too much and we don't need to know about this stuff, they're actually physically using a device whose function rests on the curiosity-led discoveries of less than a century ago.
Sibelius next, one of the great symphonies.
Yeah, so another friend of mine, a conductor, Daniel Harding, I've had many conversations with him about music. And then I asked him as a kind of joke one night, what should Kubrick have used in 2001, right? What should he have done? And he immediately said this, said Sibelius, Fifth Symphony, Third Movement. And it was written in 1915, the year that General Relativity was published by Einstein, actually, coincidentally, but of course, in the middle of the First World War. It was motivated famously by swans, the majesty of swans taken off from a lake in Finland. And so the beauty of nature.
the Allegro Molto from Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle. And in fact, Daniel Harding was a protege of Simon Rattle, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's also a civil airline pilot, you know.
I know.
One of those overachievers.
Well, we're coming to a performance of his in a moment. But first, you're planning on bringing a show to the Royal Opera House in July and August.
Yeah.
How will that differ from the Horizon shows you've done before?
It's the thing I'd always wanted to do, deliberately clashing these ideas from cosmology and astronomy and science. When you bring those ideas together in a conversation with this music, with Strauss and Sibelius and Mahler, then something emerges which is more than the sum of its parts. It's kind of a grandiose experiment. I can't believe my luck. But the idea is that we will all, not only the audience, but myself, Daniel, the musicians, everyone will walk out of that performance having had all these ideas smashed together in their minds.
So which bit of the Mahler shall we hear, conducted by Daniel Harding, to finish with?
Yes, so Mahler, famously, he was worried, concerned about his own mortality and the mortality of those he loved, and so that's in his music. There's a resolution of sorts for me in the first movement of the 10th Symphony, which is the last thing that he pretty much completed. To me, he comes to terms with his own mortality.
Well, here it is. So it only remains for me, Brian Cox, to thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
The Adagio from Mahler's Symphony No. 10 in F sharp, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Daniel Harding. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the physicist and broadcaster, Professor Brian Cox. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael will be talking to the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
The perfect soundtrack to whatever you're doing.
Breakfast with Petroc Trelawney.
We've got music for tea makers, coffee brewers, early risers, late snoozers, bread toasters, juice drinkers, dog walkers, book readers. We've got music for music lovers.
Petroc Trelawney with you on Radio 3. Very warm welcome if you're just switching on. Good to have your company.
Breakfast with Petroc Trelawney. Weekday mornings from 6:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
And a very good afternoon from me, Al Ryan, if you just joined us here on BBC Radio 3. Later this afternoon at 3 o'clock, Choral Evensong comes from Bolton Parish Church with Diocese of Manchester Choral Scholars. And then at 4, Alan Shipton presents Your Jazz Record Requests, featuring artists playing at this year's Glasgow Jazz Festival, alongside selections from Peggy Lee, Sonny Rollins, and a rare cut and archive interview material from the pianist Keith Jarrett. That's all to look forward to a little later this afternoon here on Radio 3. But now at 1:30, time to join Sarah Moore Peach for her Sunday afternoon musical journey.
Hello and welcome to Music Map, the show where we situate a piece of music within a rich sonic landscape, plotting musical routes across time and space as our ears lead us to our final destination, which today is this musical reflection. A simple accompaniment and a melody fashioned above and below it. This is Spiegel im Spiegel, Mirror in Mirror, by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. We'll hear the whole thing at the end of today's show, and on the way there, we'll be listening to music that's similar, connected, or contrasting, that might help tease our ears into shape so we can get the most out of our listening. So, to set us off on our journey, here's another piece on a similar model, Charles Gounod laying a new melody over a rippling C major prelude by Bach.